From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Oh, I'm sorry, Amy, but my English is so poor that I really cannot understand what's the important differences between Al Gore and George Bush.
Latin American writer Eduardo Galeano on the U.S. elections. Yes, today is election day, and with the tightest race in decades, we will also speak with Congressmember John Conyers and Manning Marable on perhaps for some that last-minute decision between Al Gore and Ralph Nader. Also, money in politics, what corporations will hope will happen today at the polls. With voter turnout at an all-time low, will today be any different? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Americans begin casting ballots in the tightest U.S. presidential election in decades today, as a Reuters MSNBC daily tracking poll detected some last-minute momentum for Democrat Al Gore in his race against Republican George W. Bush. Gore campaigned throughout the night in a frenetic 30-hour marathon dash to the finish line that began yesterday morning. We'll conclude this morning with the vice president voting in his boyhood home of Carthage, Tennessee. He'll then fly to Nashville to vote voters' decisions. Bush, the Texas governor, ended his 17-month quest for the White House yesterday with a late-night rally in Austin, Texas. The NAACP has asked officials in the battleground state of Florida to investigate a new rash of fraudulent telephone calls that allegedly use the civil rights organization's name while urging African Americans to vote for Republican presidential nominee George Bush. The nonpartisan National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which does not endorse political candidates, lodged complaints about similar calls in Virginia and Michigan last week, telling state officials there that someone was trying to trick voters into believing it was backing Bush. There are 204 statewide referendums initiatives on the ballot in 42 states on this election day. Among the citizen proposals are Missouri and Oregon measures to allow taxpayer-funded election campaigns and a Massachusetts proposal to create universal health care. Some measures come from state legislators, like the proposed repeal of Alabama's constitutional ban on black-white marriage, the last such ban in the nation, or Massachusetts' proposal to limit voting by felons in prison. More recently, term limits swept the country. Sometimes education and fiscal issues overlap. Michigan is considering spending tax dollars to let students attend private school if they live in a district where fewer than two-thirds graduate. Louisiana has a pair of education and tax questions. Should the state boost school funding by raising income taxes, ending the state deduction for federal taxes, and abolishing the 4% tax on food and utilities? Meanwhile, Jose Solano says he's tolerant of gay people but feels schools shouldn't give teenagers the wrong message. In Oregon, Measure 9 on today's statewide November 7th ballot would bar classroom instruction, quote, encouraging, promoting, sanctioning homosexuality or bisexuality, and would apply to public schools from kindergarten to community colleges. Also facing voters today in Nebraska and Nevada proposals to amend their constitutions to say only marriage between a man and a woman is valid. Since 1995, 34 states have enacted a ban on recognizing same-sex marriages, this according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. And Maine voters will once again decide whether to adopt explicit civil rights protections for gays, now found in 11 states and the District of Columbia. This news from San Francisco. A federal appeals court panel yesterday overturned a death sentence passed against a convicted murderer, saying prosecutors should not have argued that God sanctioned capital punishment. In vacating the death sentence against Alfred Sandoval, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said it was improper for prosecutors to suggest to the jury that destroying Sandoval's mortal body might be the only way to save Sandoval's eternal soul. State prosecutors may seek to retry the penalty phase of the case. If they do not, Sandoval's death sentence will be commuted to life in prison. Yesterday, Israeli forces shot dead a 14-year-old Palestinian boy in the northern West Bank town of Tulkarm, and a 17-year-old Palestinian shot dead by troops in the Gaza Strip. With the death of a 16-year-old being treated in a Moroccan hospital for wounds received last week, the death toll since the unrest began on September 28 grew to at least 176, overwhelmingly Palestinian. And that's some of the news at this hour.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those nights in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the wars against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA. It's coming from the sorrow in the street, the holy places where the races meet, from the homicidal bitchin' that goes down in every kitchen to determine who will serve and who will eat. It's coming to America first, the cradle of the best and of the worst. It's here they got the range and the machinery of change. And it's here they got the spiritual thirst. It's here the family's broken, and it's here the lonely say that the heart has got to open in a fundamental way. Democracy is coming to the USA. I'm sentimental, if you know what I mean. I love the country, but I can't stand the scene. And I'm neither left or right. I'm just staying home tonight, getting lost in that hopeless little screen. And I'm stubborn as those garbage bags that time cannot decay. I'm junk, but I'm still holding up this little wild bouquet. Democracy is coming to the USA. Sail on. Sail on, O mighty ship of state, to the shores of need, past the reefs of greed, through the squalls of hate. Sail on, sail on, sail on.
Democracy by Leonard Cohen here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, I bet a lot of people today will make their decision behind the curtain. That's right, behind the curtain in the voting booth, especially if their decision is between voting for Ralph Nader or Al Gore. Many in the West Coast and those in swing states may even wait to hear about exit polls in the East before deciding which way they're going to go, whether their final vote may help Bush win these elections. Here on Democracy Now!, we have given a lot of attention to this issue and what the implications would be. Today, we're joined by Professor Manning Marable, who has supported the Ralph Nader and Green Party initiative throughout this country, and Congressmember John Conyers of Michigan, who was until late last night at a Gore rally. Congressmember John Conyers wrote a piece in The Nation magazine of this week, if you're talking politics. That begins, as I've traveled the country in this election year, many progressives have asked me whether I believe a vote for Ralph Nader is justified to promote the longer-term goal of a truly representative democracy in which progressives would have a larger piece of the governing pie. My answer to them is no. Congressmember John Conyers, welcome to Democracy Now!
Great to be with you again.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Where are you now?
Detroit.
Have you voted?
No.
Have you taken your kids to school?
I'm waiting for my kids to get out of school so that I can take them with me. But I'm going to be visiting the polls all morning and afternoon. I'll be out on the streets.
Well, in a piece that Manning Marable recently wrote, it says the vast majority of African Americans who vote in the November 2000 presidential election will undoubtedly support the Democratic ticket. The national black political establishment, including more than 10,000 elected officials, the Congressional Black Caucus, key black leaders of the AFL-CIO, and paid operatives within the Democratic National Committee, have for months spoken with one voice, unanimously praising Al Gore. Congressmember John Conyers, why?
Why do we support Al Gore?
Yes.
We don't have any other alternative. And by the way, Manning Marable is a person I read and enjoy constantly here across the years. But what are we to do with the newfound power and empowerment of the Congressional Black Caucus? I was the seventh African-American member when I came in 1965. It's now 38, and there is a woman in Louisville, Kentucky, that might make it 39. What am I to do with the new power of the Progressive Caucus, now numbering 58 members, incidentally all Democrats, and the same with the CBC, for me to try to decide something different would be a no-brainer. I would be throwing away not only the potential that I may have of becoming a chairman of the Judiciary Committee that handles all the kinds of issues that you and Marable and progressives are interested in. For the first time, an African-American of progressive persuasion could be there. And if I'm working with a Bush administration, where is it going? I wouldn't expect a Bush administration to take my phone calls, much less seriously negotiate with me about all the issues ranging from reparations to racial profiling to affirmative action to watching these judicial nominations, which have been just ghastly, with Senator Hatch sitting over there blocking and stopping the diversity that Clinton Gore have tried to bring to the court scene. All together, outside of the trade and global questions, we're on different sides of the fence. And to talk about my conscience is going to limit my pragmatism is the most romantic kind of thing I've ever heard, that a 4 or 5% of a fractured Green Party, which whether it can even stay together is in question, with my friend Ralph Nader supposedly going to stay in politics and go to the head, is not even a close call for me. I don't even pause over it. And so I've been urging my progressive friends not to toss over the progress we've made in terms of a romantic perfection that rarely occurs in any political scene, much less the American.
Professor Manning Marable of Columbia University, is this just a fantasy?
Well, I think that first we have to emphasize where Congressman Conyers and the entire progressive community agree. We agree that the priority should be to defeat the right in this election. Where we disagree tactically is how best to turn out progressive voters to make a real difference. We first have to recognize that in reality, the national election is really 50 separate state elections based generally on the winner-take-all principle. The Electoral College technically chooses the president, not the popular vote. And in fact, there have been several instances in U.S. history, most recently in 1888 with the election of Benjamin Harrison, where the person who became president lost the popular vote and won the Electoral College. And in fact, I think this may happen this time. I don't think Gore's going to win the popular vote, but he very well may win the Electoral College if he carries Michigan, Florida, and Pennsylvania. So in practical terms, that means the presidential election is really already over in about two-thirds of the states. In New York, it's over with. In Massachusetts, in the bulk of the South and in the West, other than the Pacific states, Bush already has those. One could argue that in a state where there's at least a 10-point margin between Gore and Bush, people sympathetic to Nader can and should vote for him because it makes a politically progressive statement to the Democratic Party. In those states where, such as Michigan, Florida, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Tennessee, and Washington, where there is less than a 10-point margin, I would argue progressives should vote for Al Gore. And the formulation that I've been writing about is gore where you must, nadir where you can. I think that the entire political system is held hostage to corporate power. There's only one solution: the need to build a mass democratic movement to drive big money out of the electoral process and to put on the map the agenda of progressives. We need to democratize the electoral rules of the game to prevent alternative voices and perspectives at the ballot. We need to move away from these winner-take-all elections. And in fact, actually, if Gore does win and defeat the right and Bush, and he wins the electoral college and not the popular vote, we may finally, at long last, put on the table the need to abolish the electoral college, as well as to implement electoral democratize the American electoral system. So there are real reasons why, in a proactive way, supporting the nadir candidacy in those states where that election has already been decided does advance the progressive cause.
Could I add an additional comment?
Congressman John Conyers.
Because I quite agree, Manning. I'm so happy that you've made this formulation. Campaign finance reform is the first thing, or second thing. I think education is first. Campaign finance reform is the second thing on the progressive Democratic agenda, and it's been enunciated by Al Gore repeatedly. We have a bipartisan beginning to take the money out. It isn't that the Democrats are trying to sustain raising money. We lose at this business. I mean, we're outspent from margins of 2-1 on up. And so we're happy to try to close this off. And that's the first thing that we've got to do, because it increases the inequality when everything else is equal. So I agree that we must defeat the right. Now, the formulation that you put forward is one that has been suggested repeatedly to Ralph Nader, and I suppose he can't acknowledge it or won't accept the legitimacy of it, but I have no problem with that formulation. The problem that I have is when anybody of reasonable intelligence, much less super intelligence, asserts that it's okay to vote your conscience because there is no difference between the party. Now, either I've been fighting smoke battles and don't know what I'm doing, and I've been putting out all this energy, especially since the Newt Gingrich era, there are tremendous differences. Bush is going to take us back. All of the people that will be running government have conspicuously been absent from the Republican ranks ever since the convention. Nobody's seen Strom Thurmond, Jesse Held, Dick Armey, Tom DeLay, Orrin Hatch, and you won't see them until they finally get this little guy with the twisted smile into the White House, and then they'll come back with a vengeance. But we've got literally all the progressive issues, including the advancement of collective bargaining, on the table. So to me, this is not a time to be telling me about my conscience. I mean, my conscience tells me that we better keep moving forward and slipping backward, and the ability of all those who feel and think like I do that are in the Congress or will be elected, we can mount an argument to Al Gore. We're electing him. We're holding him accountable. I want somebody in the room when we pick the next attorney general. I can't say I voted my conscience, and sorry about that. It may be a few years or a decade or more before we get it all together.
Congressmember John Conyers and Professor Manning Marable, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we're going to come back to this discussion. Then we're going to be talking about money in politics with Professor Tom Ferguson at University of Massachusetts, provost there, and Common Cause. And then we're going to hear people from outside this country talk about our elections. The great Uruguayan writer Eduardo Galeano, author of Open Veins in Latin America, the premier photojournalist perhaps in the world today, Sebastián Salgado, will talk about his views as a Brazilian looking at this election of the president of the planet, as he puts it. And then we'll hear from a new foreign minister, this of East Timor, and the prime minister in exile of Burma, what elections mean to him. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. We also hope to get quick comment about David Brower's death yesterday. The great environmentalist died at the age of 88. But right now we're talking about today's election. Yes, today is Election Day, and we're talking with Michigan Congressmember John Conyers and Columbia University professor Manning Marable about who they're voting for and encouraging people to vote for. I'm wondering, Congressmember John Conyers, on the issue of, well, at least you have him in the room with you if you vote for Al Gore, what about when it came to NAFTA, World Trade Organization basically came out of President Clinton and Vice President Gore, and they're pushing for these international trade organizations. Did it matter if you had them in the room with you, the tremendous lobbying campaign to push NAFTA through despite the objections of the constituencies that elected them, like labor?
No, it probably wouldn't have mattered because we had them in the room. The first time ex-Governor Clinton hit Detroit, he's been besieged by that ever since 1992, and we did not succeed. But the proof of the failure of NAFTA and WTO is now becoming more clear, and the support is becoming larger and more effective within the Congress, and particularly the progressive Democratic community, to begin to make some change. Its failures are now the best arguments we could put forward, which we weren't able to do then. So I think that we will have even more success with Al Gore than we did with Bill Clinton.
Manning Marable.
Well, I think that even though the outcome of the election is in question, and clearly from the progressive standpoint, Gore would be preferable in the White House than George Bush, we have to ask ourselves candidly, how did we get to the situation where millions of progressive people would willingly defect from the Democratic ticket? I think that Gore there are many ways in which Gore is to blame in this formulation. I mean, take the issue of capital punishment. Gore easily could have sent a message to the progressive wing of the Democratic Party by taking a position that was as enlightened as the Republican governor of Illinois, who called for a moratorium on the death penalty. But Gore didn't do that. Basically, the Democratic Party platform of 2000 rejected liberal positions on literally every major issue, not just capital punishment and globalization, but health care and military expenditures. So that the selection of Lieberman, for example, Joe Lieberman was one of only 10 Democrats, including Gore, to support former President Bush's war on Iraq. He has flirted consistently and promoted voucher schemes to divert money from public education. Back in 89, he supported a Capital Danes tax cut. He embraced Clinton's brutal 1996 Welfare Act. So that, in effect, the Democratic Leadership Council's politics are really represented by this ticket. And to progressives, when the selection of Lieberman indicated that the Democratic Party was moving even further to the right, if Gore had sent, not just rhetorically, a kind of populist-sounding rhetoric, but had there been some recognition that the base of the Democratic Party, which is, after all, African-American and labor and women's organizations, feminist organizations, had acknowledged some of the positions that they had taken, Gore would not have been in this position. And last thing, and this is something I'm wondering if Congressman Conyers could talk about. The irony is that Gore ran a campaign running away from Clinton. Now, Lord knows, Clinton has been, in many real ways, a deep disappointment, not just for progressives, but people across the Democratic Party. Nevertheless, he has a 60-plus percent approval rating. And consequently, by running away from Clinton, he can't claim that the good economy is his own, and he runs away from the accomplishments of the administration. And I'm wondering why Gore has run the kind of campaign that he has.
Well, I'm happy to try to respond to that, because we wanted President Clinton more in the mix. But what we found out that the Bush campaigners were cleverly doing is that anywhere Clinton showed up in a state, they would tear up Bush's schedule and schedule him in another part of the state in which we were trying to take over a competitive congressional seat, or that the pollsters showed that there were enough uncommitted and undecided that would undo building our reinforcing our base where Clinton is so powerful. And I argued strongly for the same strategy that Professor Marable has indicated, until I talked with Al Gore and found out that it wasn't a matter of ego or trying to distance himself from the accomplishments. If you've listened to Gore on the stump, he takes full measure for the support for his contribution there. But let me just point out about, I agree with you that there should have been a statement about the moratorium, that even a person supporting the hate crime, of supporting the death penalty, have been doing that. But here is a vice president and a president that have come out behind hate crimes. That's the anti-lynch law that Du Bois and the early NAACPs of the 1930s were trying to get through. They've come out against racial profiling, which has long been a sensitive point. The President Clinton actually implemented racial profiling among all the federal police forces that he could put into effect a executive order that would have some effect. They've come out against secret evidence. The president vetoed yesterday the Official Secrets Act, which would have brought about great penalties and prison sentences for those who were possibly working as whistleblowers or people trying to bring forward evidence. And on health care, good night. Here we have Gore saying we should have universal health coverage for all children. That's the first step toward the kind of health care program that we've all been talking about, a patient's bill of rights. We're the ones that can't get it even when there's bipartisan support. I mean, the Republicans are determined, because they're in the hands of the insurance companies, the HMOs, and the pharmaceutical industry. And of course, drugs for seniors under Medicare is a Democratic alternative. So we're inching toward, to me, and I'm very pleased with it. Now, Lieberman was the smartest choice that Gore made, and it was the beginning of the the resurgence that was one of the several things that happened at the convention that, in my mind, was a brilliant stroke to take out this fanatical hatred of Clinton that exists among the ranks, not because of some moral question that they like to use as the scapegoat, but because he created more diversity than any other president in history.
Professor Marable, we just have 30 seconds. Your final response.
Well, I think we may not agree on Lieberman. I mean, this is a guy who was the co-founder with the notorious Lynn Cheney, former chair of the NEH and wife of Dick Cheney, of this organization, the American Council on Trustees and Alumni, that opposes affirmative action, so-called and political correctness, and defends Western civilization. I think the real issue here is to defeat the right. I think it's important for us in those states where we can to support a progressive politics that's represented by the Green Party. It has real problems. It has not made adequate efforts to reach out to Black, Latino, and poor communities. And if we are the greatest victims of corporate power, and as long as the Green Party remains overwhelmingly white, they will lack the capacity to build or even maintain a truly democratic movement. Nevertheless, a vote for Nader in those states where we can make a real difference in building a progressive movement outside of the Democratic Party, and I think that's important.
Well, I want to thank you, Professor Manning Marable, Professor of History and Political Science and Founding Director of the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University, and Detroit Congressmember John Conyers. This is your, 10th term?
No, that was a long time ago. Let's see, this is probably my 17th, 18th
wow.
term.
And
I'm the second most senior member in the House of Representatives.
And if the Democrats were to take power, you would become chair of what committee, can you say?
The Judiciary Committee that controls the constitutional amendments, the Department of Justice, immigration, criminal law, drug disparity issues, and intellectual property.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, Resistance Radio. Money That Matters by Randy Newman here on Democracy Now! As we go to that issue on this election day, money in politics. We're joined on the telephone right now by Thomas Ferguson, contributing editor to The Nation magazine and senior associate provost at the University of Massachusetts Boston. Also joining us in the Washington studio is representative of Common Cause, which has put out an Election Day toolkit on this Election Day to help people navigate their way through the election. We're joined in the studio in Washington as well. Let's start with Tom Ferguson. Money in politics on this Election Day.
Well, look, the question is, what about it? Do you see it today? Pull out your New York Times business page. Take a deep breath because you're going to actually read something there that's a true analysis of the world. Yesterday they report people are buying pharmaceutical stocks. They're rising. Why? Because they think Bush has the election. In fact, this will be your best guide to telling what the polls, which are, you know, business groups pay to have these things taken all during the day. A lot of these folks in the stock market will know the results by about 12 to 1 unless they're really too close to call. And you can just watch by some stocks to sort of see what they know, even if you can't be told there. And the striking thing, this is an election where, boy, if you've ever seen a straight political economy of interest groups at work, this is it. I mean, you can see the tobacco stocks, pharmaceuticals, probably some of the defense firms too, as well as the for-profit medicals are going to take a huge gain out of this thing, and apparently started to do it yesterday, you know, if they are lucky enough to be right. I mean, this is telling you something. Reality is trying to send you a message. It's that an awful lot of money is in this election because an awful lot of money is going to turn on it.
We're joined by Jeff Cronin of Common Cause. Senate candidates raised a record, $335 million through September 30th. What is Common Cause doing about this?
Well, you're right. Senate candidates have raised that much money, and House candidates have raised another 550 more. I think what we've seen in this campaign 2000, is a complete disintegration of the campaign finance laws in this country, where the illegal money, money from corporations and unions and wealthy individuals, is threatening to eclipse what we consider to be legal money, the money that falls under the federal regulatory umbrella. I think this election makes a really good case why we need full public financing of elections eventually, because with all the other issues on the table in the presidential campaign, and indeed many of these House and Senate races, whether it's prescription drug prices or the future of Social Security and the extent to which it might be privatized in the future or patients' Bill of Rights, all of these issues are really being fought out by these special interests in the airwaves and it's consumers who are being largely shut out of this debate. So come February, we want John McCain to keep his promise to bring the Senate to a grinding halt and push for a vote on at least banning the worst of these abuses with the McCain-Feingold bill. And then, you know, there are signs that there's a lot of momentum for full public financing of these campaigns. We're fighting for referenda in Oregon and Missouri, which would call for public financing of state elections. So I think there are some signs of hope on the horizon, too.
Can you tell us about the toolkit that you've set up on this election day?
Well, we've put out an election night guide to money and politics to give people kind of a thumbnail sketch of what's happening in campaign 2000. From our point of view, we're just seeing a kind of campaign finance gluttony in this cycle. All told, campaign 2000 is going to cost upwards of $3 billion. It represents a kind of corporatization of American politics that's really unprecedented. The other thing that our studies show is that the current campaign finance system, really more than anything else, is what protects incumbents and keeps the turnover rates in Congress so low. 89% of House incumbents are either running truly unopposed or virtually unopposed, in that they'll have such a huge financial advantage over their challengers that their races will be financially uncompetitive. Incumbents are having a 4-to-1 financial advantage over their challengers, and when it comes to PAC money, money from special interests, incumbents have roughly a 7-to-1 advantage, and in the Senate the ratio is about the same. So when you look at all the money that's being spent in campaign 2000, I don't think it can be just attributed to the rate of inflation. This isn't some kind of spontaneous outburst of philanthropy from corporate America. Come February and January, when the new Congress comes back and a new president, you know, the chits are going to come in, and all these donors are going to, you know, who have strings attached to these contributions are going to pull those strings, and it's going to end up costing all of us as taxpayers billions of dollars in the form of corporate welfare and special tax breaks and giveaways, largely to corporate America.
If people want to get the guidebook, where can they go on the web?
Go to commoncause.org, and you can find our election night kit and other great resources on money and politics. You should also check out the Center for Responsive Politics' excellent website at opensecrets.org on the web,
and
you can find out who's funding the races in your district.
Tom Ferguson, finally, who is investing in this election, and what implications does this money have for popular movements and third-party politics?
Well, I think one implication it has for the popular movements is it's tough to get them organized. You can see that in the tremendous imbalance between Nader and the other major candidates, let's say, who are running. I mean, George Bush didn't even bother to take matching funds to run in the primaries, and he still, you know, outraised everybody's cash. The other side of this, I think, somewhat more subtle. You know, you got to spend some time, too, not just on campaign finance, though. There's nothing more important than fixing the campaign finance system in the United States, because that is the way you can fix everything else. It's clear you're going to have to do something about the presidential debate system, where it is essentially virtually a wholly owned subsidiary of large firms. And you could see it very vividly this year when they wouldn't let Nader in and sort of wouldn't even let him in to watch the debate when he had a legal ticket. I mean, that system needs to be the whole presidential selection process, including the sort of nonpartisan, officially nonpartisan parts of it, is unfortunately rotten to the core. It's all got to be changed.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Professor Thomas Ferguson, again, Senior Associate Provost at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and with us in the studio in Washington is Jeff Cronin of Common Cause. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll hear from people outside this country looking at our elections, from a great Uruguayan writer, Eduardo Galeano, to Sebastián Salgado. You've probably seen his pictures if you have not heard his name. Then we'll speak with a new foreign minister and a prime minister in exile. And then we'll remember David Brower. Stay with us. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. About 100 million U.S. citizens, half of eligible voters, are expected to stay away from the polls today, marking the lowest turnout in the past 40 years. In fact, U.S. turnout lags behind many other countries, especially low among young and Latino voters. Meanwhile, outside U.S. borders, from Europe to Latin America to Asia to Africa, millions of people are watching these elections very carefully, aware that their lives will be directly affected by the decisions of the next president. As one activist from Guyana said to us in Seattle at the protest there, Jocelyn Dow, she said, "We, the poor people of the world, should also be allowed to vote in U.S. elections because the U.S. president makes decisions that impact our lives directly." Well, this past weekend, I was in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where I had to speak with two of the world's great artists of Latin America. Yes, I talked to Uruguayan author Eduardo Galeano. He's written many books, including Open Veins of Latin America. Also, Brazilian photojournalist Sebastián Salgado, who, well, you may not know his name, but his images are all over the world. Heartrending images of women, men, and children who've been plucked from their land, whose lives are a permanent exodus. His latest project is called Migrations. These are the images of those on the other side of U.S. foreign policy, of IMF and World Bank programs. And I ask them about the U.S. elections. We start with Eduardo Galeano.
Eduardo Galeano.
Your thoughts about the U.S. election.
Oh, I'm sorry, Amy, but my English is so poor that I really cannot understand what's the important differences between a George Bush.
Sebastio Salgado, your view on the U.S. election.
For me, it's very difficult to give an opinion about the U.S. elections, concerned with what's going on inside of the United States. But for me, when we elect a president of the United States, in a sense today we're electing kind of a president of the planet, because of the most powerful country, and the influence is enormous. The only thing that I want to say to the one or other that will be elected as president is to pay attention to what's going on outside the United States, mostly in Africa, because today we cannot leave back out of any consideration 20% of the world population. Africa is completely abandoned, and I believe that the new president of the United States must do something in that direction.
I'm just wondering, in terms of the reception of your work here in the United States versus how it's received in other countries, and tying this into the election, is the way the U.S. public sees politics in the rest of the world. How do you perceive it as an outsider who brings your work here?
I believe that the United States must pay attention to what's going out of here. I see, for example, what I read in newspapers, that there is not a big interest what's going out of here. I see by the number of pages of the foreign politics in the newspapers, a very, very few. And but I believe that probably we must change this interest, because all this health that's concentrated here is coming from many different parts of the globe. It's not just the what is produced in the United States. All this financial system that was created, basically what's being produced outside is being transferred here. And I believe that something must go back. We must pay attention to this, because, my God, we cannot leave just 4% of the world population, what represents the population of the United States, and abandon all back, mostly the underdeveloped countries in Latin America and Africa and part of Asia.
Sebastio Salgado, world's leading documentary photographer from Brazil, and Eduardo Galeano, the Uruguayan writer. We now turn from artists to politicians who have themselves been in exile, like Galeano and Sebastio Salgado, who were forced to leave their own lands because of military dictatorships. We turn now to a new foreign minister. He is José Ramos Horta, just named foreign minister of East Timor under the UN transition government.
My name is José Ramos Horta, member of the transition cabinet in East Timor, in charge of foreign affairs. Elections in the US are the ones that are most closely followed by everyone around the world, because of the power of the United States in influencing, in shaping events, policies in this country necessarily affect the lives of many. The other day, a friend of mine, a Democrat, said she wasn't so distressed because, well, anyway, we survived 8 years of Reagan. I'm not obviously commenting on the Reagan administration. I'm just quoting the friend of mine, and I said, but do not think only of whether you survive 8 years of Reagan. Ask other people around the world what impact the Reagan administration had on other countries. My point is, regardless of who is elected, and I will not comment on that because it would be interference in U.S. Electoral process. Regardless who is elected, there will be positive or negative impact to the lives of millions of people around the world. And that's why we all follow with a lot of concern, a lot of interest, elections in this country, both for the White House, but also for the Congress itself.
What did the elections in Timor mean? Not exactly elections, those will be next year, but the referendum. What percentage of the population came out for that? Here in this country, less than half the population comes out to vote.
in the last year referendum on independence, almost 99% of people over the age of 17 went to register their vote. And that was extraordinary, not only the high number of people, but also we must remember that for many months they were subject to terror campaign, vicious terror campaign to discourage them from registering and from voting. And in spite of that, thousands of women, older people, some people were sick, and yet they walked hours, women with children on their back, line up from the early hours in the morning to cast their vote, the vote of their conscience. What an extraordinary display of courage by our people.
Well, I'm Dr. Sein Win. I'm the Prime Minister of the Government in Exile from Burma. We call National Coalition Government of Union of Burma. Well, we hoped that whatever the results of the next election, presidential election, the U.S. policy on Burma will be going ahead with continue, because we see no change, no visible change, no significant change. In fact, it is deteriorating on the ground. So we don't see why the U.S. policy should change because of the change of the president,
And what do elections mean for the people of Burma? What would elections in Burma mean?
Well, of course, this means a lot. The people of Burma has voted in 1990 elections, and they voted overwhelmingly for the change, for the National League of Democracy, led by Dr. Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel laureate. And that means a lot. And NLD, National League for Democracy, won overwhelmingly. So that's the, what the people want.
Do you think there will be elections again in Burma?
Well, we are for looking so that the last time election results will be implemented, in the sense the people vote for democracy, the people vote for change, the people vote for justice. So this is what we want.
And what is happening with Aung San Suu Kyi right now?
She is under house arrest, and not only she is under house arrest, the whole leadership of the National League for Democracy Party is under house arrest. The military has put arrest those people who accompanied the Aung San Suu Kyi to the railway station. They are putting pressure on all the members, and they are trying as best as they can for the eviction from the headquarters in Rangoon. So it is really a very hard time.
Why did she try to go to the railway station, and what was she doing?
Well, she wants to go outside Rangoon. So although she was said to be not under house arrest since 1995, actually she was restricted in every possible way, physically, So she could not go out of Rangoon for any, context. So she wants to show that, that in Burma there is no such thing as freedom of movement, So she tried to go to Mandalay by, train.
And what happened?
Well, the military don't allow it, and then they were taken her by force and put her under house arrest.
And what kind of pressure? Are you satisfied with the U.S.'s pressure? Or do you think the U.S. could do more?
Well, we always said that the whole international community should do more.
What?
Well, we are talking about sanction, selective sanction. And then we are also talking about pressure, to send a strong signal that the military cannot get away with what they are doing now.
What about this information about Halliburton, Dick Cheney's corporation, the largest oil services company in the world, helping to build the oil pipeline of the Burmese regime?
Well, we just read it very few weeks ago. And of course, we have our policy, we have our own view, and we have that all those views declared a long time ago that any kind of investment, not only from U.S., not only from one company, all kinds of investment right now is not helping the people, not helping our cause. That also hold for European Union investors, you know, like Premier Oil, Unocol is from U.S., Premier Oil, Total from France, you know. So all kind of that kind of investment is not helping our cause.
Dr. Say Nguyen, Burma's prime minister in exile, East Timor's foreign minister José Ramos Horta, Brazilian documentary photographer Sebastião Salgado, and Eduardo Galeano, the great Uruguayan writer, talking about U.S. elections. And finally today, David Brower, recognized around the world for his pioneering leadership in protecting the environment and wild places of the earth, died this past Sunday at his home in Berkeley, California. He was 88 years old, first executive director of the Sierra Club, founder of Friends of the Earth. Ralph Nader has called him the leading environmentalist of the 20th century. He also founded the Earth Island Institute, where we go right now. McKeel Davis is with us, director of the Brower Fund of the Earth Island Institute. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Can you give us a brief thumbnail sketch of David Brower's life?
David Brower's life began rather quietly. His father was a professor at UC Berkeley who was laid off during the Depression, so it was kind of a hard time growing up, particularly since his mother became blind when he was only 8 years old, so his father had to support them on a meager salary with four kids. But when Dave's mother went blind, all of the family, in spite of being poor, had a love of the outdoors, and they would take them out there. And Dave ended up being his mother's tour guide, where he would have to go and be her eyes and describe to her. They would go on hikes together, even though she was blind. She was still pretty sure-footed. And he would have to be her eyes and describe the wonders of nature to her and give her that experience secondhand. And David spent the rest of his life doing that for the world, giving people the experience of the wonder and magic of nature. And people in numerous obituaries that have been written will describe him as militant or angry. And those of us who know Dave well don't think of him that way. I mean, Dave had his moments of anger, but I think underneath it all, Dave was driven by love. He was driven by the love of the natural world, just as he was as a boy, you know, at 8 years old, describing to his mom the view from the top of Grizzly Peak in Berkeley of the entire Bay Area. You can imagine that, you know, very little smog, no Golden Gate Bridge, no Bay Bridge. So when Dave, you know, dropped out of college.
We have 10 seconds.
In 1931, it was, as his wife says, before he had learned what was no longer possible. And that's what Dave spent the rest of his life, showing people that what they thought was impossible in defense of the earth was not impossible.
McKeel Davis, thanks for being with us, remembering David Brower. You're listening to Democracy Now!